This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. Search To Die For in your podcast app to follow the show.
Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. Now, enjoy the show.
Today's date is January 22nd, 1989. The time is approximately 7:30 p.m. I'm at the Florida State Prison. I'm going to interview Ted Bundy.
But to the extent that, in the event that anybody, especially families, want to know, I'm sorry.
Hannibal Lecter, crazed cannibal and manipulative mastermind. Norman Bates, psychotic charmer and peeping Tom. Hans Beckert, killer of children. The names of cinema's greatest and most well-known serial killers. They've commanded the attention and fascination of filmmakers and audiences for nearly a century. Many of them based on real-life counterparts. 1950s serial murderer Ed Gein alone has inspired nearly a dozen films, including the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But unlike their big screen representatives, the day-to-day life and personas of real serial killers are, in a single word, boring. This isn't to say the lives and actions of these people are anything short of fascinating. They are, on a whole, just really good at blending in. Masterful liars, manipulators, and overall egotists. In retrospect, the number one thing you're likely to hear about a serial killer is...
He seemed like a good guy.
He was a good guy.
Nice, polite, seemed normal. You would never know.
You would never know.
You would never guess that he could be so awful.
Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and this is Serial Killers, a new podcast diving into the minds and motives of serial killers. This week, we look into the mind of Ted Bundy, one of the most infamous serial murderers. If you want to listen to any episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all in your favorite podcast directory. Don't forget to subscribe. You can also listen on our website, parcast.com, spelled parcast.com. A new episode comes out every Monday. Visit our Facebook page, Parcast, to join the conversation. I'm joined by my co-host, Vanessa.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to Serial Killers.
Vanessa will be answering questions I have about the mental makeup of a serial killer. What makes them tick? What molded them? And what their thought process is like, as well as providing other valuable insight. It is important to note that she's not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but like me, she's fascinated by the psychology of serial killers and has done a lot of research for the show. So right off the bat, how many serial killers are there active at any given time?
Well, there are as many as 50 serial killers living, working, and killing in the U.S. By the way, that's 0.00000015% of the population.
Wow, that's much less than I expected.
Yeah, it's an extremely rare phenomenon, incredibly inflated by America's fascination with serial killers. That being said, the 60s and 70s were a hyperbolic breeding ground for sex murderers.
I thought it was the time of free love.
Exactly. Free love, screw the law, and the popular slogan, if it feels good, do it.
It's a sweet mantra.
Indeed. But it can be a dangerous philosophy when adopted by a madman who feels good raping, butchering, and defiling young women.
Point taken.
The free love movement also made it easier to find victims. The rise of the singles bar, gay bathhouses, and other similar places of the era gave lease to a lot of opportunity.
I have a feeling that our subject today may have taken advantage of this fact.
Absolutely. Ted Bundy is a poster child for the 70s lust killer.
Ted Bundy was an American serial killer and rapist who operated from 1974 to 1978. His spree of over 30 women, combined with his charming, irresistible outward personality, made him an instant icon. America could not get enough of Ted Bundy, and Bundy couldn't get enough of America. The expert liar and manipulator tried to take charge of the public, as he did with all of his victims. He exploited weaknesses and struck hard. Bundy's time as a serial killer was short, but he remains an incredible study due to his Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde performance, as well as the bizarre, deranged acts he committed, all of which we'll discuss over the next 2 weeks. We know that there was a rise of serial killers in the 70s.
Yes, but just like there might be a rise in shark attacks any given year, that usually means a marginal markup of just a couple of percentage points.
I guess because of the rarity of these attacks, any increase at all probably seems astronomical.
Precisely.
Okay, then when did serial killers really get going?
Well, murder and atrocious acts of violence are a tale as old as time. While many people tend to think of serial murder as a more modern phenomena, acts of perpetuated aggression can be traced all the way back to our more primitive roots. And sexually motivated violence has always been a component of human behavior. There is even scientific evidence that suggests a taste for savage cruelty is innate to our species, encoded in our DNA. This violence is recorded throughout history.
I think it was Atreus of Greek myth who served as inspiration for Sweeney Todd.
Oh, little boys. Little boys, come to your Uncle Atreus. That's it, yes.
The myth goes that Atreus butchered his brother's sons and baked them into a cannibalistic pie.
Then you move on to the endless legends of knights,
Vikings,
Sinatra!
And pirates,
arr!
Who raped, pillaged, and murdered in times of non-war. The normal cause was just a bit too much mead. Because of the lack of laws in these times, none of these actions were considered serial murder.
Huh. I guess these murderous streaks were not illegal. So humans with that urge were able to purge.
Not to mention, if there were serial killers, the general public had no way of knowing. The pre-industrial world had no press. It's no coincidence that the world's first, quote-unquote, famous serial killer rose with the rise of literacy.
Get your paper here. Illustrated Police News has all your stories. Crazed killings in London. Mass hysteria.
Say, young boy, what's the paper say?
Gotta pay to read it. That's the deal, sir.
I'll take one.
Tragic death in London. They're calling him Jack the Ripper, they are. He kills women in the dead of night.
Of course, Jack the Ripper wasn't the first sex killer, but he was one of the first to be made famous by the media. The industry made a profit off death, and Jack became an anonymous celebrity. This was the true start of pop culture's fascination with the dangerous predators amongst us.
But far from the end.
Take the early 1990s, when Ted Bundy was one of many faces featured on serial killer trading cards. Forget baseball players or Pokemon. True crime cards sold over 1 million packs in 1992 and are still available on eBay. It's clear the love affair with violent icons still rages on today. But amongst all legacies, if there was a singular charming golden boy that the media fell hardest for, it was Ted Bundy. The man defended himself in court in a Seattle Mariners shirt, a suit jacket, and a smirk. After conferring a death sentence, even Judge Coward had to say,
"Take care of yourself, young man."
"Thank you."
I say that to you sincerely. Take care of yourself. It's a tragedy for this court to see such a total waste, I think, of humanity that I've experienced in this court. You're a bright young man. You made a good lawyer. I'd love to have you practice in front of me, but you went another way, partner."
Ted Bundy looked like a good guy. Soft-faced, big smile. A hard-working, self-assured ladies' man with a true sense of heroics. If you were to run into him in the early 70s, you'd be talking to a young man enrolled at the University of Washington who worked part-time at a suicide prevention hotline. He'd been lauded by the Seattle Police Department.
"Mr. Bundy?"
"Yes, officer?"
"I want to commend you for your work today. It took real guts to stop that purse snatcher."
"I was just doing what any good citizen would do."
"Fine work. Thank you."
What might not be so obvious to these officers is that this young man would go down as one of the most lethal killers in U.S. history, a career thoroughly documented by the American news media. So, how can two seemingly opposite personalities and behavior outputs coexist within the same mind? And where does it all begin?
Both important questions. We'll start in 2005, when Radford University conducted a study of 50 lust killers.
Lust killers?
Well, serial killers who killed with sexual, lustful intent.
Like Ted Bundy?
Yes, usually with cooling off periods between each kill, separating serial killers from those who go on killing sprees. In the study, it was found that 50% of the lust killers studied had experienced psychological abuse as a child, while over a third had been on the receiving end of some sort of physical abuse. 68% had some type of maltreatment, regardless of abuse type, in their past.
Why might physical, sexual, or emotional abuse raise the chances that a child would grow up to be a serial killer?
Well, abuse during childhood could be considered a contributing factor toward creating a dysfunctional way of dealing with others. The punishment they received consistent with the punishment they later dole out.
So someone who is abused sexually...
Right. Lust killers do tend to follow a specific trend, but not all of them. That brings us to Theodore Robert Cowell, a.k.a. Ted Bundy, a man and killer with, fascinatingly, no documented child abuse.
Born on November 24, 1946, to Louise Cowell in Burlington, Vermont.
Like Bundy, 43% of serial killers were not raised by both biological parents.
Right. While Lloyd Marshall is technically listed as Ted's father on his birth certificate, there's no proof that this man actually exists. But it wasn't long before Ted was given to another father figure.
Louise? Louise, what are you doing here?
Dad, meet Theodore.
I asked you a question.
I need you to take him, Dad. I can't do this.
You're just going to disappear?
No, I'll be right here. Just to take care of him for me. He'll call you Daddy, and he can call me Sister.
And if he ever finds out...
He never will. I promise.
Sam Cowell, Louise's father, pretended to adopt Ted. And so he grew up confused, thinking his grandparents were his birth parents. Bundy was quite fond of them. Sam was reported to have a violent temper, but there are no signs it was ever directed squarely at Ted. Vanessa, how did this affect Ted's perception of manhood?
Well, Sam was an unruly man, as well as a tyrant, racist, and homophobe. Rumors of his beating of dogs and violence towards a neighbor's cat fall in line with a story about the man throwing his daughter, Ted's Aunt Julia, down a flight of stairs because she overslept.
So his lone male role model was, while possibly not abusive to him, abusive around him.
Correct. Leading by example.
Ted even went as far as to tell his friend Ann Rule that he looked up to his grandfather, that he identified with him.
Was his grandmother any better?
Not quite.
"Where am I?"
She often submitted herself to shock therapy in an attempt to treat her depression.
"Get away from me!"
But it only made her more unpredictable, more reclusive. This bizarre environment was surely contributing to Ted's dark tendencies beginning very, very early. At the age of 3, he terrified his aunt.
"Oh! What is it? Oh my God!
Ted! There's knives all around me!
Ted!
He's just staring at me."
In the summer of 1951, Louise met Johnny Bundy at an adult singles night at the local church. It wasn't long before the two were married and Ted finally inherited his final last name. The newlyweds would go on to conceive four more children, none of which Ted was very friendly with. Yet in his final interview, he was quoted saying,
"I grew up in a wonderful home with two dedicated and loving parents, and one of five brothers and sisters. A home where we as children were the focus of my parents' lives, where we regularly attended church, two Christian parents who did not drink, they did not smoke, there was no gambling, there was no physical abuse or fighting in the home."
A key thing to remember anytime you hear words straight from Bundy's mouth is that he was a genius-level liar and manipulator. He was known to say what people wanted to hear, and this applies to his relationship with his stepfamily. The good parent he claims to have in Johnny here is the same man he called dim-witted to Ann Rule. In one of his last confessions, Bundy asked Detective Couch,
"And I would trust that to a certain extent you're not going to just run back to Salt Lake City and tell the press everything that I said, and that you're more interested in solving the case."
Absolutely.
"And letting the families know without reawakening all the pain by putting details in the paper that would."
"That's my first and foremost reason for being here, for those three girls that are missing and
some more."
Even at the end, Bundy was manipulative. He frames his request in empathy for the families, but I'd wager he wanted to protect his public image, so he played into the detective's sympathy in an attempt to keep the confession secret.
It's worth noting that, in that particular confession, Bundy takes long pauses before answering any question.
Right, you could tell he was thinking about his answers, trying to maintain control over what information got out.
Mm-hmm. Here's more evidence of Bundy's outright lies, caught in court, no less.
"Well, you started off with a lie, too. You do recall your testimony during the courtroom proceedings in Utah, do you not?"
"I'm not sure what you're referring to. I think really, it's a broad question. If you try to be more specific, I can help you out."
Caught lying to the police and trying to charm his way out of it. What makes serial killers such good liars? Or is this a trait unique to Bundy amongst killers?
Not unique to him, no. But Bundy lied until almost the end, and he was very good at it. It's important to note that serial killers think very highly of themselves.
I guess it takes a great amount of ego to think you can get away with murder.
Exactly. Lying makes them feel superior, powerful. Serial killers have an amazing grasp of other people's emotions. They revel in manipulation.
In the case of the interview we just heard, Bundy was already sentenced and mere days away from his death. Why lie?
It's a compulsion, plain and simple. The media played so hard into his persona, he couldn't stop himself from wielding some sort of sway over how people continued to perceive him.
Are these traits developed as a defense or coping mechanism?
Well, if there's one thing killers like Bundy are good at, it's rationalization.
Lets them sleep at night.
Mm-hmm. And Bundy learned how to do this at a very young age. Being as smart as he was, he recognized fairly early that he lacked certain human qualities.
You mean a conscience?
Conscience, moral compass, call it what you want. Either way, Bundy had neither.
How aware of themselves are serial killers like Bundy? Do they know what they're doing is wrong? Or that they're even lying in the first place?
It honestly depends, case to case. There are situations in which the killer becomes larger than life in their own eyes. People like Manson are above it all. Part of a movement, something larger. What they were doing was not wrong in their eyes.
Terrifying.
Intensely so. And that's a mighty feat because most serial killers are extremely intelligent. Their academic understanding of the world is not shallow. So the other flip of the coin is a complete and utter lack of empathy. They know, they just don't care.
Bundy himself even said,
"I'm the most cold-hearted son of a bitch you'll ever meet."
That lack of empathy definitely is something that starts young.
Well, by the time Bundy was 15, he'd become an expert shoplifter and was a suspect in two burglaries. He saw himself as above the law, acts of arrogance, narcissism, and entitlement that led to Ted becoming a peeping Tom. All acts that seem minor when it's highly likely that, though never proven, Ted claimed his first victim at the age of 15. Ted was a paperboy. Along his route, there lived an 8-year-old girl named Anne Marie Burr. She took piano lessons from Ted's great-uncle Jack. On August 31st, 1961, she was found missing from her home. There was no sign of struggle at the site.
This means that most likely the girl knew her kidnapper.
And neighbors reported having seen someone looking through their windows some day before. Bundy had, by that point, developed into a skilled peeping Tom. Little Anne Marie was never found. Bundy's later history has led many involved to think he was the perpetrator. But at the time, he was free to continue his academic pursuits.
We'll return to our story in just a moment. And now, back to serial killers.
Bundy attended the University of Washington in 1966. It was here that he would meet the quote-unquote love of his life. Bundy became romantically involved with a beautiful brunette that most people referred to as Stephanie Brooks. Her real name was Diana Edwards. She was wealthy, worldly, and parted her hair down the middle.
Partly in an attempt to impress Diana, Bundy volunteered for Nelson Rockefeller's presidential campaign, even attending the 1968 Republican National Convention as a Rockefeller delegate. But his immature personality would often get the better of him.
He frequently jumped out of bushes at Diana in an attempt to scare her. It wasn't long before she dumped Ted for his immaturity and laziness. Their relationship lasted a year.
It's probably the closest Bundy ever got to feeling real love and his first experience with sexual intimacy.
Bundy was heartbroken. He quickly dropped out of school. Is it possible that this relationship ending pushed Ted closer to his killer streak?
Ted absolutely would have seen this as a rebuke from the female population. Maybe not enough to really push him over the edge, but he was certainly closer to finally snapping.
If he hadn't already.
Exactly.
Is it possible that if the two had remained together, tragedy could have been avoided? Or are people like Ted going to find excuses to act on their demons no matter what?
Well, I don't think there was any stopping his metamorphosis. Ted Bundy most likely would have become the Bundy we know, whether the two had stayed together or not.
The time after the breakup left Ted in a tailspin. He needed to find direction. He needed to find out who he was. Ted went home to Philadelphia in search of some answers. But his biggest discovery came in Burlington, Vermont.
Hi, welcome to Burlington City Hall. How can I help you?
Hi, yes, I'm here to recover a copy of my birth certificate.
What's the name?
Theodore Robert Cowell.
Did you fill out the proper forms?
Of course.
Okay, great. Give me one second. Here we are.
Thank you.
Is everything all right?
No, actually, there's an error. This is incorrect. It says here that my mother is Louise Cowell.
Well, if that's what it says, that's what it is.
No, this is a mistake. Louise is my sister.
For those keeping score at home, this qualifies as the second perceived major betrayal against Bundy by a woman in a very short period of time.
An impact that would imprint upon Bundy for the rest of his life.
Bundy commented on his relationship with his newfound mother.
Didn't talk a lot about real personal matters. Certainly never about sex or any of those things. My mom has trouble talking on intimate personal terms. There's this logjam of feelings in her that she doesn't open up and explain.
Ted quickly picked up a new relationship in the fall of 1969, this time with Liz Clofer, a young divorcee from Utah. She was smart and shy and more devoted to him than Diana ever would be.
But it didn't change the fact that below the surface, Bundy was full of intense, pent-up rage and thirsty for violent, lustful revenge.
In 1971, he took the aforementioned job at Seattle's Suicide Hotline Crisis Center. There he met and worked alongside Ann Rule, a former Seattle police officer and aspiring crime writer who would later write one of the definitive Bundy biographies, The Stranger Beside Me. Ann described Ted as, and I quote, kind, empathetic, sympathetic. He'd always walk me out to my car. And he'd say, be sure to lock your doors. I don't want anything bad to happen to you on the way home. If somebody had told me that this man was perhaps the most dangerous man in America to a woman, I would have said you're crazy. End quote. Bundy's natural likability earned him good money, law school, and in 1973, he restarted a relationship with Diana while still with Liz. Ted mentally and literally separated the two, neither knowing of the other's existence.
The skill to sequester aspects of one's life came in handy not only in a literal personal sense, but when it came to deeper things like emotions.
This compartmentalization was the number one trait that helped Bundy kill as many people as he did. On Friday, January 4th, 1974, Ted Bundy began his five-year streak of terror, a murderous rampage that would make a nation question everything that is holy.
I'm going to bed now.
Don't let the bed bugs bite.
Stop it. Don't forget to lock the front door.
There is no definitive reason why someone starts to kill, or how someone can kill.
Someone like Bundy doesn't just go crazy one day. To our new listeners, this section of the podcast goes into detail on some of the most horrific actions committed by man against man. If summaries of incredibly graphic and disturbing murders may upset you, please feel free to skip ahead, or look out for our episode recap. Just after midnight, Bundy entered the home of Joni Lenz. Joni was an 18-year-old student at the University of Washington. She slept peacefully in the night as Bundy slowly made his way through her house, crowbar in hand. Joni, still unconscious, Bundy proceeded to beat her with the crowbar before removing a rod from her bed frame and sexually assaulting her concussed body. She was found in the morning lying in a pool of blood.
Someone call 911! Joni, wake up! Wake up!
Joni would survive, but live on with permanent disabilities. This set a standard for Bundy's entire killing career. Sexual attack, possible kill. He had priorities, right, Vanessa?
Undoubtedly, and that's normal for lust killers, to value the assault more than the kill.
How often did he need to kill?
Well, for Bundy, it was like a balloon constantly being inflated. If air isn't let out... Bundy waited all of 27 days to pop again.
Bundy's next victim was also a Washington student. On January 31st, Bundy broke into the bedroom of Linda Ann Healy and knocked her unconscious. He then precariously dressed her in jeans and a t-shirt before wrapping her in a bedsheet and carrying her out. It wasn't until a year later that they found her remains.
Our story will continue in a moment after a brief message.
And now, back to our story. Bundy would go on to kill at least one girl a month from January 1974 through June 1974 in the states of Oregon, Utah, and Washington. But like his first victim, not all of them ended up dead. Bundy offered Rhonda Stapley a ride in 1974. When he took her on a detour, she thought he wanted to kiss her. He leaned in close and whispered, "You know what? I'm going to kill you." Stapley fought off Bundy as he repeatedly strangled her, letting her breathe just enough to stay alive so he could continue toying with her. After Bundy raped her, Rhonda managed to escape and fell into a river, which rushed her away, saving her life. This was considered lucky.
Rhonda was also a college student, a young, attractive brunette with her hair parted down the middle, a description that fits most, though not all, of Bundy's victims, a description that also applies to his ex-girlfriend, Diana.
What does it say about Bundy's psyche and inciting incident that his MO became so clear so quickly?
It tells us that he felt deeply, deeply betrayed by both Diana and his mother. Some would call it an all-time grudge.
Well, a case could be made that that hairstyle was also just plain common in the 70s. Is there any chance this was all coincidence?
Well, all in all, over 20 of the 35 eventual Bundy victims fit this mold. Take those numbers for what you will, just not coincidence.
Talk about holding a candle.
With his new outlet, Ted felt he had proven a point against Diana.
In 1974, Bundy cut communications with Diana without warning. She wrote and called endlessly, only reaching him once.
Ted? Ted, is that you?
Yes.
She never heard from him again. Others weren't as lucky.
It should be made very clear that once the killings began, any illusion Bundy once had of possibly living a normal life, of marrying, entering politics, becoming a lawyer, raising a child, they were all gone.
During this time, Liz, Bundy's now longtime girlfriend, began to notice Bundy's metamorphosis. On July 6, 1974, she and Bundy decided to go on a rafting and picnic trip down the Yakima in Washington. Their relationship was under a lot of stress at the time. Ted had frequent mood swings, and starting around the week of his first recorded attack, began to request a variety of new sexual acts. This included anal sex, bondage, and more aggression. Liz couldn't and didn't want to keep up with these newfound desires, and Ted's sexual need for her soon disappeared. A fact that also worried her.
This is nice. I like it when we can just sit. You can tell we're good together because we don't have to talk to have a good time.
But inside, Ted's bloodlust and sexual rage boiled. After a brief lunch, Bundy and Liz took to the water once more.
I appreciate you coming out. It's been really nice. I really mean it.
Liz later described what happened next.
His face had gone blank. I had the sense he wasn't seeing me. I could find no expression on his face.
The Ted she knew was no longer by her side. And then...
What? Ted! No!
Ted pushed Liz into the moving water.
Why did you do that, Ted?
I'm sorry. It was a joke.
You scared me.
Jeez, don't take things so seriously. It's just a bit of fun, right? I thought you wanted to have fun together.
Yeah, but I'm soaked.
Well, then, we'll get you dry. It was nothing, really. Come here. Come on.
That was cruel.
Shh. It's okay. We don't have to talk. You're right. We're good together, even when we don't talk.
Bundy was masterful at this sort of manipulation and compartmentalizing. A killing would have no impact on his later mood or appetite.
Why should his day be deterred by a couple of dead girls?
His thoughts exactly. In his mind, once their last breath escaped, they bore no value to the world. Surely they'd be forgotten.
But in fact, their stories would never be forgotten. Not by the families, not by the historians, and not by the people who had to discover their remains. Well, it looks like Bundy's killer profile shaped up nicely. We can run down what we have with a little help. Name, Ted Bundy. His background?
Messy, possibly abusive, definitely tragic.
An understatement. How does he trap his victims?
A combination of stalking, sneaking, and later in his killing career, luring.
And his killing MO?
Sexually based, blunt beatings. Later on, dismemberment and necrophilia.
He was also organized in his routine. A routine that claimed over 30 victims over the Pacific Northwest, Rocky Mountain states, and Florida. But the self-described coldest son of a bitch alive ultimately paid for these murders with his life. That brings us to an eerie conclusion of this week's Serial Killers. Return next Monday to discover more about Ted Bundy's victims, his eventual capture, multiple escapes, and the media circus trial that brought it all to an end. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget to subscribe to Serial Killers on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory, or through our website, parcast.com. That's PARCAST.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Please let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's P-A-R-C-A-S-T Network. And as always, we thank you for listening. Have a killer week. Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It is a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admire. Serial Killers is written by Patrick R. Young and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Jerry Courtney Alstein, Mike Capozzi, Wendy McKenzie, Nicholas Massu, and Stephen Pinto.